Have you ever given it thought about what your subconscious was trying to tell you?
Well, I think beyond what I've shared, it was an overwhelming feeling that I was never ever going to get to the answer. Like I was never really going to be able to work it all out because we use the thing to work out, like we're using the brain to work out the brain. And since then, I've become fascinated in different forms of intelligence that we have as a part of being human. So body intelligence, heart intelligence, gut intelligence. And if I had the knowledge that I have now back then, I may have taken a different direction.
Hello and welcome to Bringing Design Closer, and this is HCD. Our goal is to have conversations that inspire and help move the dial forward for organizations to become more human-centered in their approach to solving complex business and societal problems. My name is Jerry Scullion. I'm a service designer, a human-centered designer, an educator, and obviously a podcaster here on This Is HCD. In this podcast, I speak with Melisse Sanova, author of this human and soon-to-be-published book, Design Character. Now, on Melisse's website, they say that I help leaders find a deeper source to fuel their potential for leading others to have great impact in the world. And this is something that really rang true in the conversation with Melisse. And we speak openly about their own journey of self-discovery and journey that has led her to a PhD in human-centered design, co-founding Huddle in Melbourne, and now running her own design community for designers titled This Human. I'll throw a link to that one in the show notes. But before we jump in, I have a favor to ask. Look, I've been creating content here at This Is HCD for nearly 6 years, all for the love of really sharing knowledge to the global design community, and I love doing this. But one thing that you could do for me is just leave a review wherever you listen to the podcast. It really helps the podcast grow, helps us grow our community across the networks like Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. So if you do get a chance, every little helps. And even if you don't leave a review, you can go one better by telling the people that you work with about the podcast. They might find it interesting too. Thanks so much. Let's jump straight into the episode.
The whole illustration thing was an accident. And there's something really freeing about not having my identity connected with being an illustrator, because I just draw stuff and stick it out there and I don't really, there's nothing.
Personal.
Whereas my friends who are artists are just like, they're really, it's not good enough yet. It's not exactly what I want to draw and all of this sort of stuff. So.
Well, they are wonderful. I think they're wonderful because they're unique. And when you see them, I'm like, okay, well, that's part of that brand. So it's doing its job.
Thanks.
Melisse, I'm delighted to have you here. We've been chatting for quite a while and, for 5 or 6 years, actually, to be honest. But I'm delighted to finally have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Jerry.
Your name's been mentioned to me so many times over the years. But for anyone who doesn't know you, maybe give them an overview of what you do and where you're from.
Sure. Well, thank you, Jerry, for persisting and having me on your show. I'm very happy to be here. Yeah. Maybe I'll go backwards in time as opposed to a sort of a normal chronology. I'll do it in
your engineering background.
Sorry?
Tell us about the engineering background.
Let's start there. Okay. So my sort of career or education started when I was doing sort of biomedical engineering, and I majored in neurosciences. Okay. And I was always fascinated with how the human brain worked and how we made sense of the world and each other. And so that's what I did. And that took me to Japan, where I did a bunch of brain research. And I had a moment where I was just trying to understand whether or not this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And what I realized was I was more interested in understanding how this brain that I was studying interacted with the world and how I could better design that interaction. So how humans meet the world that they occupy, and really understanding that because our brains are so different, our realities are so different. So that became a really fascinating question for me. So how do you design for these multiple different always present at the same time.
Always realities changing.
That people, yeah, yeah.
Are you afraid to talk about the eyeball?
Yes, I can talk about the eyeball. So the reason why I decided to shift my focus from becoming sort of a brain researcher, scientist person to a human-centered designer was while I was in Japan, I had a dream. And the dream was of an eyeball in space that was frantically trying to see itself, literally. Mm. It was just turning round and round and round. And I woke up that morning and I just felt like, my gosh, you know, I'm using the brain to try and work out the brain, and it just felt a little bit futile to me. Mm. It just felt like I'm using the brain to try and work out how the brain works. And, you know, because I studied sort of engineering, there was a bit of sort of systems theory and systems thinking and stuff that I had already learned about. And I was like, don't we need a higher order system to make sense of a lower order system? So I got into this bit of a, you know, I just realized that it wasn't for me. And then I did my PhD in human factors, and I was interested in sort of high performance. So, you know, when you've got the human system pushed to the absolute limit and you've got technology pushed to the absolute limit, what role does human factors and design play in improving performance when both of them are maxed out? So, of course, that meant fighter pilots and jets and all of that kind of stuff. And
let's go back to that eyeball a little bit. So,
I'm loving the eyeball.
I just think it's a really nice symbol. Symbolism.
Yeah.
What do you think, what's your interpretation of what was happening there in the dream? Have you ever given it thought about what your subconscious was trying to tell you?
Well, I think, you know, beyond what I've shared, it was an overwhelming feeling that I was never, ever going to get to the answer. Like, I was never really going to be able to work it all out, because we use the thing to work out, like we're using the brain to work out the brain. Mm. And since then, I've become fascinated, and this is something we haven't spoken about yet, Jerry, in different forms of intelligence. So that we have as a part of being human. So body intelligence, heart intelligence, gut intelligence. And if I had the knowledge that I have now back then, I may have taken a different direction perhaps. But in that moment, I was just like, I can't, I'm never going to get there.
It's interesting, because how do you see organizations hiring for different types of intelligence? Is that something that organizations are at a point that they can consider? Or is it typically a skills-based attribute that they're looking for, like in terms of fill the gap? Because there's so many different types of intelligence. I remember when I was a teenager, and I'm not saying I was stupid, okay, right? But in school, I was very artistic and creative in those senses, and I didn't probably fall into the categories of academic excellence, or is probably the nice way of saying it. And one of my friends, their mother, their brother and sister, was really smart. And she said to my friend, Derek is his name, said, Scully, which was my nickname, Scully isn't your typical person to come out of that school. He's got so many other types of intelligence going on. And I was like, is that a backhanded compliment? Is that a backhanded compliment by saying, like, and I remember at that stage, mid-90s in Ireland, I was like, I wasn't able to accept that. I didn't understand it. But now I kind of understand myself an awful lot more over the last 15 years. But going back to that question, how do organizations, in your experience, hire? Is it for one type of intelligence, or are they even at that point?
Well, I think all organizations are grappling with what it means to be truly diverse. yeah. and inclusive.
Yeah.
You know, back when we were building Huddle and we have always had a philosophy that good design happens when you have multiple and diverse worldview views around a table. And but one of the things that we did learn about that was that you also need a culture that can withstand that, because if you do have differences of perspective and different ways of thinking and different ways of working and different needs around your creativity, then that also causes friction. It causes creative friction. It causes, which I have always advocated for, I think that's a good thing. But around that, you need a culture that can withstand that. And that takes a lot of effort.
Yeah.
And I think that there are, you know, especially for large organizations that have got a whole bunch of other things that they need to manage from a risk perspective and, you know, a legislative perspective and a governance perspective, it becomes really difficult to do it, I think. And that's not an excuse that I'm giving them, by the way. I think that it's a really, really important thing for us to get right. And design and creativity only benefits from that, in my view.
I mean, I do some of my best thinking when I'm doing the dishes, and I was doing the dishes this morning and I was thinking about what it means to be a good service designer, okay, in particular. And one of the strengths that I can see is the ability to communicate and be succinct and bring people together and have a pretty high EQ in terms of being able to read situations and read your timing and stuff. And we can talk a little bit about what that might mean in the remote sense and the distributed teams, but the different types of intelligence, the social intelligence, is the bit that I'm really interested in. What's your experience with teams hiring for that? Because if you look at the application process for how people are hiring, it tends to be either a portfolio, maybe a conversation, maybe some Zoom calls, and then they get in, and then it's the real test. What's your take on how teams can hire for that social piece? Because that's the integral part, I feel, for teams to be hiring, and not always for that social person, but being aware of the different strengths of the person.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the way that hiring is done is really, first of all, trying to work out individual aptitude, right? So skills and worldviews, and there's so many different tests and stuff that you can do at an individual level. And then there's sort of, if it's a really thorough hiring process, then there's sort of group activities perhaps. And I know that at Huddle we had, we had sort of an initial interview, and then we had a bit of a working interview, and then we had the can you have a beer with this person interview. And so we were doing a few of these sort of rudimentary, I would call them, tests. But I feel like, just like in service design, what makes a really powerful service designer in my view, and also what I've witnessed, is someone who can see the in-betweens. So and I've always said the magic exists within the gaps, so within the transition points between this and there. And I think it's also true in relationship. So it's the person who can see the in-between dynamics, the things that aren't said, the tension that's being held, and those things can only be witnessed and learnt relationally in group. So you've asked me a question about what do I know about how organizations recruit for this. The answer is I don't know much about it.
Yeah. Because that's fair enough.
I haven't really witnessed that much of it. Yeah.
Well, one of the bits that we were chatting about before was the kind of the reframing of the conversation that a lot of organizations and a lot of practitioners as well, to be fair, talk about. The outcome of our design efforts, like it's on the end experience and the end outcome for the business and the customer. And what I really like about where you're working with now with the new book, Design Character, available on thishuman.com. joking. We're not going to go into a sales pitch, but or maybe we will. When you're joking. What I really like is about the reframing of the importance of the practitioner and getting to know who yourself is and what you stand for and your principles. And that really echoes a lot of the stuff that I'm hearing when I coach people as well, because I think something that's happened over the last couple of years with COVID and the pandemic is people are really starting to tap into what it means to be me and how I fit into this big system. Tell us where your experience came from. Obviously the eyeball was a pivotal moment in your life, that spinning eyeball. And I think that might've just reading between the gaps, might've put you on a trajectory towards self-identification of what you want to do. Yeah. With your life. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Have I made that assumption? Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. That's a good assumption. I think there's another pivotal moment, which we haven't touched on, which you actually, there was a reference to this film in your previous episode.
Top Gun. Was it? Yes. You're joking me with Carl. I had a need for speed.
It was so funny because, because when 1986, so the first Top Gun film came out, my father and I went to watch it, and there's a scene, and I recently spoke in Aruba at a leadership conference called Lidera, and I opened with this story, because it was all about purpose and leadership, and there's this scene where Kelly McGillis's character Charlie, she walks out. It's after the famous, you know, you've lost that loving feeling scene.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And you know, she gets introduced, and you know, she has a PhD in astrophysics, and the Pentagon trusts her, so I think you should. And she's going to be, you know, assessing you on your flight performance and all this sort of stuff. And she turns around, and here's this woman with a PhD in astrophysics. She works at the Pentagon, and she's standing in front of the top 1%. You know, the world's best of the best, and she's got something to teach them. She's got something that's going to make them better. And I remember sitting there and going, "I want to be her."
You want to be Kelly.
There was something in me that just kind of went, I want to be that person who gets to continue to contribute to the growth of people who are already doing amazing stuff in the world. And I feel like that's kind of where my career has sort of circled back to that moment now, where my entire focus. So I've sort of finished up in the middle of last year with Huddle and fully focused on sort of This Human and thishuman.com and the next book and creating courses and stuff that help people who do this work be able to understand that they can never ever separate the designer from the designing. So they need to understand who the designer is so that they can be resilient to the forces that we are, as people who do this work, are going to be coming up against more and more as we push into the status quo.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were in Australia for a long time. You would have been here when there was the Royal Commission into the financial services sector. Yeah. And it was just like people were like aghast and agape with like, what's going on? And these were people, you know, so many of our colleagues were working in this industry, you know, so it was like, for me, it was like, what is happening here? You know, and I really dug deep into that. And what role can I play? What role does this interest between who we are and what we create become relevant in these places?
Yeah.
And I landed on this term called moral fading, which is this sort of slight, sort of incremental, almost imperceptible shift of your presence in the moment of decision making, because someone who's more experienced than you says, oh, that's the process, that's how we do things around here, just fill out this form, follow that process, submit that thing here. And what I've understood now is that if I can support people to establish clarity within themselves around what their values are, what type of ethics they actually prescribe or subscribe to and what their ethical practice is, and have clarity and confidence around their voice.
Yeah.
To be able to say, actually, no, that's not okay. And it's not okay for these reasons. I cannot participate in that. I feel like we're going to have a force, you know, a workforce of designers around the world that are going to become more and more potent.
And I totally agree. I mean, that's a really nice, it's really nice ambition and a mission, a vision all at one, to work towards that.
Yeah.
We could look at academic structures, okay, because if you look at how designers are being produced, okay, they go through, and a lot of the people that I've met over the years tend to be, and I'm lucky enough to have worked with a lot of excellent designers. The best designers I've worked with are non-design educated. And that is something that really kind of, sorry, I've got a frog in my throat. Really kind of is an eye opener. I'm like, well, if there's design structures there and there's design academics out there, why are the best designers sometimes non-design educated? Why do you think that is? And by the way, some of those,
I feel like, it feels like a bit of a, like I'm going to pull the pin out of a grenade and kind of
no. This is where, out there. This is where grenades.
I feel like, you know, I've now for the last few years started teaching back into sort of graduate, so master's graduate level design courses. And one of the things that I've observed is that there is a focus on tools, process, you know, pulling together portfolios, how to execute on a design, how to do so with quality. Increasingly, there's a little bit more sort of client relation type stuff, how to fulfill a brief, you know, in the studio type classes. But I don't think at any point, you know, there is a module that talks about, well, how do you need to develop yourself as a person to be able to withstand the complexity, pressures, uncertainty that comes with being able to do this work? And I wonder whether or not people who are not design educated have come into design uncertain.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they don't necessarily have the tick or the qualification or the so they've had to bring in multiple different perspectives, multiple disciplines into their emerging practice of design that they're learning as they practice.
Yeah. It's also like those great designers of a couple of people in my mind, they definitely know who they are and they've been through an awful lot. Okay. They've experienced a lot of life things. And then they could be immigrants. They could have gone through separations, whatever it is, but there's definitely moments in all of their lives that they've had to sit back and reflect. And that's something that I found to be very powerful when I was looking at that kind of pattern amongst those. I would put them down as the top performers, the top 1%. How did you go about finding out who you were and what you stand for? What was your journey in that process? If not personal, Melissa.
No, not at all. I've always had, not always, for the last 16 years, I've had a reflective practice in the mornings. And my version of that is journaling. So I have a journal and I write in it, and I've got many, many of them now.
Yeah.
And old school, like with a fountain pen on paper, you know.
Okay. Nice.
And one of the things that I realized that process enabled me, and I feel like it's the only process that we have to really have an experimental approach to having the witness on board to kind of go, well, how did you go yesterday? And you know, that conversation, or you know, that workshop that you ran, and what happened there, and how did you feel, and what's going on, and just that sort of inquiry.
Yeah.
Because we're so good at doing the inquiry when we're interested in someone else's life.
Yeah.
But obviously there's some barriers to be able to do it to yourself. And what I realized was the clearer I got around where my boundaries were around what's okay, what's not okay in every aspect of my life, but in particular when it came to my practice around human-centered design, the more people listened to me.
Yeah.
The more people were quiet when I spoke, and more people would say, "Oh, you know, how do you speak so confidently about, how do you advocate so strongly for design?" And where that was coming from was really just this, it was just coming from this place of clarity. Like I was just really clear. And I feel like that's the, and I talk a little bit about that actually when I'm teaching the design character material, because when you do become clear and you become more articulate in what your practice is and what's okay and what's not okay in your boundaries,
yeah,
then stuff starts to come back at you.
Yeah.
And so there's this whole part of that which is around self-care. It's around understanding how to have really difficult conversations, how to process difficult conversations, because they're the types of conversations you end up having.
Do you think it's fair to say you need to go low to really rebuild? Because if people are those top 1%ers, as you referred to them, if they're high achievers and they're kind of looking to build on it, I think sometimes it's harder to get them to come to the table and say, well, it's just another thing for me to do. Whereas if you've almost gone low in terms of like you have to rebuild yourself, these attributes are much harder or much easier to adopt because they're self-care related, and you're building from that point of being quite low. I mean, low in terms of the mental health kind of state. I mean, I think after the pandemic, a lot of people are looking for ways to maintain their health, get to know themselves an awful lot better. And journaling was one way. I did it a number of years ago with The Artist's Way. I don't know if you remember The Artist's Way.
I do, yeah.
And it's really good. And in a former life, I was a singer-songwriter, and it was something that I was blown away by how powerful it was.
The morning pages.
Yeah, the morning pages. But what I want to ask you about, say you do those things, the reflection pieces, and I want to pull you back to a term that you said there about 10 or 15 minutes ago about moral fading. How does that affect you in your practice at the moment? Like, you know, because you're not immune to these things. They can arrive, and just because you do a practice doesn't mean that you still have to be aware of it. How does that affect you? Can you tell us a little bit more around how you handle that?
Well, I feel like there's a couple of things. Well, there's a lot in that question, but there's a couple of things I want to talk to. And I might forget the second one, so I'll say both of them now, and then you can remind me.
Spit them out.
So the first one is the word reflexivity.
Yeah.
And the first one is that, and the second one is about forgiveness and acceptance. Okay, so bring me back to that point when I forget, because I'm going to... So one of the things that I learned about all those years that I did my reflective practice was that nothing really changed unless I did something different. And so that's the whole reflection in action piece. So I have always had an experimental approach to my life and obviously to my work. And I say obviously because design is an emergent practice that requires an experimental attitude. Yeah. And what I realized was that when I sat in reflection and I was able to understand, okay, so perhaps I could have listened differently in this conversation, or I could have stood up for myself a little bit more in this moment, then I created a little, and I call them action experiments, and I have them in all of my courses. I would create little action experiments for myself where I would actually do something different. And that the extent of that experiment was, and I now have language around it, was outside of my comfort zone, but it was still within my confidence zone. So I was uncomfortable. I was doing something different. It was a little bit scary, but I also knew that I would survive what was about to happen. So I was confident that I was going to get through, but I didn't necessarily know how it was going to go. And once I started, and that is actually called reflexivity, so reflection in action.
Yeah.
So I feel like that is one part of this whole, you know, working with moral fading that's fundamentally crucial, is that whenever you reflect, whenever you get insight, you've got to put something different into practice and learn from that.
And build from that.
The second thing I think I said was around forgiveness, right? Yeah. And that is that, and I did this whole talk at South By a few years ago around the dark side of human-centered design.
Yeah.
And that is that a lot of, and there's this beautiful paper actually, which is called Beyond Good Intentions, and I'll send you the link so you can share it. And that's actually about power literacy. But we all approach the work that we do, I think, with the intent to, you know, improve an outcome for the people that we're designing with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can always do all of the things, have an ethical practice, do as much research as we possibly can, have a reflexivity practice as well. And inevitably we're gonna do something wrong. We're gonna miss something. And I feel like one of the things that we also need to get really good at is being able to accept that you're not gonna get everything right all the time. And to actually have a forgiveness practice around those things where you kind of go, I actually did absolutely everything that I knew to do in the moment and I still got that wrong. And to pretend to be able to go, I'm going to do better next time because I've learned from this. Yeah. And there have been times where I've been coaching designers who are transitioning from being a practitioner to a leader. And because they're new, they're really experienced designers, but they're beginners at leading. They make a few missteps. They say the wrong thing. They go too hard or they go too soft or something, and they're still trying to find their way as leaders. And they lose their confidence. And then they keep going backwards in their performance as a leader because they take a hit from a self-esteem perspective.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's really important to maintain is that practice around, look, I'm always, always, always going to show up and I'm always, always, always going to do my best and I'm not necessarily going to get it right every single time.
So when you're, when your confidence is hit like that, I think that's a lot of people will have felt this at some point in their career. What advice do you give to people in terms of getting the strength to show up again? Because in my experience, I remember years ago I had an incident where I was in a bank. And someone asked me why I was here, and I go, well, I'm here to design the service, like, you know, they go, but why are you here? And I go, what do you mean, like me personally? Like, why are you here? And I'm like, fundamentally, like, on this planet, what are you talking about? And they're like, yeah, we don't understand why we've got design in the room. And I'm like, oh, conversation beyond me. But I remember after that, I had signed up to Toastmasters a few years before, and I kept on going to Toastmasters, you know, practice my public speaking. And I went to them and I was like, oh my God, my confidence is in the toilet. I said, like, absolutely, it hit me to the bone. Like, you know, and I was mid-30s. This wasn't like years and years ago. And it took me months. You know, I was like, I was, you know, dodging the whole kind of like presentations. I was like, oh my God, I'm afraid he's going to be in the room. And he got in my head. And that guy, like, you know, I since heard he was redundant, and I did open a bottle of wine that night, but but it did get in my head, and I was finding it really difficult to just to show up again. And it just took Toastmasters actually helped me get back on my feet in terms of rebuilding the confidence. And that was just getting up in a safe space and, you know, allowing myself to be vulnerable and learning myself to say, oh, that actually wasn't anything to do with me. It was more to do with him. What advice do you give to people who go through those situations? And for anyone listening, like, you know, maybe you've got perspective on your own experience. How did you do it, Melissa?
Well, oh gosh, if you're ever, you know, in a situation where you're not wanted in the room, which unfortunately in our line of work can tend to happen, you take a hit, and I've had many. I've taken many hits like that. And in particular, when you get it wrong in your own business as well. So there are times where, you know, we tried to do things and we just really messed it up. And then I had a unfortunate practice of feeling like I was sort of responsible for absolutely everything and everyone.
You know, superhero and complex.
That was, yeah. You know, and until I realized the arrogance actually that sits in that a little bit, you know, that you are so powerful that you are responsible for, you know, everyone and everything. But I would get really affected by things that didn't go as I intended. And one of the things that I did learn was that, you know, I think you do have to give yourself some time, like this whole bounce back attitude, you know, chin up, buttercup, get on with it, you know. I just feel like, you know, people who self-select into this industry of really understanding the human condition and trying to create to better it or to assist it in some way or to provide more access, you know, these types of people are hopefully, you know, sensitive humans so that they can connect with other people's realities. And it's a little bit like it does come with the terrain. And so we need to be patient, and we also need to practice the, this is not all about me.
Yeah.
Like this is not all my fault. This is not all about my inadequacy or, you know, the amount of people I've worked with that are suffering from imposter syndrome. I feel like we're overrepresented in the design industry.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, everyone, even people that have got all the degrees and all the PhDs and all the experience will still say, you know, I was in the room and I felt like an imposter.
Yeah. It's when like the more you know, the less you feel confident.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a juxtaposition in that whole kind of mindset. One of the things that we were speaking about, and I know I'm jumping between topics here a little bit, but the unconscious design, I remember that term that you said earlier on.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about this and what it means.
Yeah. So it was another thing that drove me to start focusing on this sort of intersection between who we are and how we design and what we design and why we design. And that is that, you know, there's so many restrictions inherent in the relationships that are formed between, say, a design agency and a client organization, right? There's a contract, there are deliverables. And in some organizations, you know, those deliverables or those outcomes need to be prescribed during the procurement process, let alone at the beginning of the project, or having them emerge through understanding of the people that we're trying to serve. And so what tends to happen is these, you know, these structures, these artificial structures get into the heads of, you know, the design teams and the leaders. And what I would see is a design process that's trying to meet a particular criteria or literally like a checklist of, we've got personas done, you know, journey map done, report done, systems map done, and in amongst that and the pace that's expected and the urgency which this work is done within, creates a really difficult context for designers to actually just stop and kind of go, well, actually, is this appropriate? Like, are we doing work in the way that we believe in? You know, are we honoring the opportunity that's been presented to us in a way that's actually aligned with who we are and what we want to do? And this isn't, I'm not talking about being a purist and, you know, following the design process to the absolute. That's not at all, has never, ever been my philosophy.
Yeah.
But what I am advocating for is for designers to understand that just as it is important to become proficient at all of the tools of the trade and the frameworks and to keep up to date with trends and all of that, as that is all very important, it's also really important to do the work on yourself and understand, well, how do you talk about your own personal values and what is the rub with your personal values and the values of the organization that you work for, and how do you negotiate that? So I'm not saying only work for organizations that are 100% aligned with your values. I think that's not, you know, the engineer in me says that's impractical.
Yeah.
But I feel like the inquiry needs to be present so that you know. You know, one person who's in my network is really clear on her values, and she's working for an organization where there is no values alignment right now. And she knows that, and she's there conscious of that. And I feel like, and she's there for another reason, right? She's trying to get a different type of experience. She has deliberately put herself in that context. And I feel like that's the difference. So when you understand where you are and you know you're there for a particular reason and you have chosen, you have agency around that, that's conscious. When you haven't done the work and you happen to be doing the type of work that you're doing and you don't necessarily have this critical lens on that, that is what I'm referring to as the unconscious design. Yeah.
So that's really interesting, because I think it's very easy for us to say that you should do the work on yourself, figure out who you are, and then match yourself to organizations that live to those values. That's what most people will be championing. I know that's what I've kind of done over the last 10 years. Like, I got opportunities to work for gambling companies. I was like, I can't do that. It doesn't, I can't wake up in the morning, put my head in the pillow at night and be comfortable. It's really interesting and refreshing to hear a different perspective on that. If you challenge yourself though at that level, and you're working, you're taking money from a system that is dysfunctional and it's ultimately destructive to the fabric of society, what benefit is that to the human?
Yeah. Well, it's even, you're touching on a topic that is even bigger than what we've been talking about at the moment, which is the transition of my perspective from human-centered design to, you know, whatever we want to call it, but more than human. And I've just finished reading, listening to the most amazing book called New Ways of Being by James Bridle.
Okay.
And I'll send you that link as well. I think you will personally love it. Where he talks about the delusion, these are my words, not his, by the way, but the delusion that we have as a human species, that we are the most intelligent.
We're not.
And one of the things that I really, you know, with all the work that I'm doing, I believe is possible is a global mindset transformation over time, where it becomes inconceivable for us to participate in the design of systems that are extractive to planet and to people. I really believe that. And I believe that the pathway to that is through this type of work, and this type of work is around connection. Connection to self, connection to each other, connection to planet. And one of the things that I talk about a lot in why I'm serving the community that I'm serving, which is this community of what I call world creators and world builders, like people who, whether it's a pixel on a screen or a service or a policy or a strategy or an organization, you know, these are worlds that we're creating. And more people that do this type of work that understand where what their fabric is, what their foundations are, and get closer and closer and closer to a way of being together on this planet that is appropriate for everyone on it. And I'm talking beyond human, animals, plants. Like, imagine having a role in establishing that.
Yeah.
Like, that is, I can't think of anything more
important.
important. I want to say noble, you know, like to be able to do that.
So what does it look like? So I know you've got thishuman.com and how do you enable the self-reflection? Like, is obviously you coach as well. I coach as well. What kind of things can people expect? Because you've got a community there at This Human. What can people expect for Melis to offer that enables? And this is not for me to set up a soapbox, but I'm interested in the self-reflection piece. For me, I use a psychologist. So I love someone to challenge me, look at my life, challenge. So I'm always doing that. It's not like something that I do in blocks. I always tap in monthly. Okay. So it's like going to the gym for me. Is that something similar that people can expect at thishuman.com?
Yeah. It's really deep work. And one of the things that I noticed in my coaching practice, and I think it's a nature of the type of interaction or space I end up creating with people, is that it becomes a very intimate, and I don't obviously mean that in the way that it's typically used, but it becomes a very close and connected dialogue. And so what I've started to do very recently is I am now training in body-centered psychotherapy. And the reason why I'm doing that is because I have had to hold, and this is part of my ethical practice when I'm working with people, a really clear boundary between the professional context, which I feel qualified to talk about because I've lived it and my experience is there, versus the personal context where I don't feel qualified to talk about because I don't have that training, that therapist training.
Which is brilliant.
And so in my, and in my coaching practice, you know, I've always been really clear about what that line is. And I established the relationship at the very beginning going, when I know all of this is one for you, but this is where, this is the dance space. This is where we are.
It's really important.
But now what I realize is that the type of work I want to do with people is deeper than that, and it needs to be deeper than that because this plays out in every aspect of our lives, actually, this transformation. And so I'm busy educating myself and getting qualified to be able to hold a more inclusive space for people.
Melis, we're coming towards the end of the episode, and you know, again, I'd love to invite you back because there's other bits that we didn't really get to weave into the fabric of this conversation. If you're up for it, I'd love to do another one in a couple of weeks about ethics, because I think we've got a lot of common ground in that space, and I'd love to hold space with you on that. I've really enjoyed chatting with you, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart. I try to be as honest and transparent, but just being open and vulnerable enough to talk to me about even the dream that you had, I know that was, I might have pushed you into an area that you were like, oh, okay, here we go. I'm somewhat vulnerable here. So I really appreciate you giving me that time and the energy. And I know it's Melbourne evening at the moment. So I appreciate you meeting me at that time as well. For people who want to stay in touch and, you know, find out more about you, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best thing to do is to go to thishuman.com, and everything is there. The links to the community, the books, the courses, all the information is, awesome. Is there.
I'll put a link to those in the show notes, and I'll also drop a link to your LinkedIn as well if anyone wants to connect with you and learn and follow you as you go along. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jerry. It was an absolute pleasure.
There you go, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you enjoyed it and want to listen to more, why not visit thisishcd.com, where you can learn more about what we're up to and also explore our courses whilst you're there. Thanks again for listening.